This is BDO in the Boardroom, a podcast by the BDO Center for Corporate Governance for the Board of Directors and those charged with governance. We're joined by your board peers and inspiring leaders to discuss the trending and timeless issues that are impacting today's boardroom agendas. Let's get started.
Hi, I'm Amy Rojic, Director of BDO's Center for Governance, and I'm very happy to have the chance to sit down with fellow BDO colleague Damon Pike, who is a principal and technical practice leader in BDO's National Tax Office, specializing in customs and international trade services. And today, we will be discussing what the board needs to know about the dynamic tariff environment and current global trade wars. But first, a little bit about Damon. And unfortunately, we don't have enough time today to talk about all of his accomplishments, so I'm going to boil this down as briefly as I can. So Damon founded the Customs and International Trade Services Group within our firm's international tax practice in 2019, and he has 36 years of experience. He now serves as the technical practice leader for the firm's CITS team, providing end-to-end global consulting services for import-export planning and compliance. He is renowned for his expertise in harmonizing transfer pricing policies and customs valuation requirements, as well as his work on country of origin determinations, free trade agreements qualification, and customs controversy matters. He also advises on export compliance and controls, particularly in the context of government contracts under the Trade Agreements Act. And prior to his current role, he has run his own firm and has also served as the national director of a Big Four firm's customs consulting practice. And he has experience in the legislative and judicial branches of the federal government, and is an adjunct professor at Emory University School of Law. So Damon, very brief description of your career and accomplishments. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here. There's not much to talk about these days, but I'm sure we'll find something, right, to
yeah, cover. I'm sure. Perhaps before we dive in, it might be helpful for you to give our listeners a brief update on the current tariff landscape, specifically pertaining to U.S. actions and other countries' responses to those actions. I know this is an evolving situation and it's changing daily, but it may be helpful to hear a synopsis to date. And right now we're sitting in early April. So again, just to set the expectation.
Well, sure. We had a preview of what was to come during the presidential campaign last year, and a lot of those promises, it turns out, have been kept. And so I look at it as the day one America First trade policy, where the broad outline of what was to come was outlined. And that literally was released on January 20th on President Trump's first day back in office. And it set forth basically 10 different areas of things like trade deficits, unfair trade practices that the administration was going to cover in reviewing new tariffs. So it didn't take very long before the first wave of these new tariffs came out on February 4th. And the president used a statute that's never been used before to impose tariffs called the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, or IEEPA. That allows the president, without any congressional involvement, to declare national emergencies and then to take economic measures to counter those declared national emergencies. So in the case of IEEPA, the first two emergencies that were declared were the flow of fentanyl and precursor drugs from Mexico and Canada, as well as China, and also the flow of illegal migrants from Canada and Mexico. So those were the basis for the first round of new tariffs that were announced. And again, these came out on February 4th of 10% on China, 25% on Canada and Mexico were paused later. But all of these tariffs were designed to address that International Economic Emergency Powers Act situation. After that, the president further extended the tariffs by what's called the Section 232 National Security Tariffs. He originally imposed tariffs on steel and aluminum products that were dating back to 2018, and mainly raw materials. What's different here is that not only were those tariffs kept in place and the duties on aluminum products were raised from 10% to 25%, steel had always been at 25%, there were many exceptions under the previous round that allowed most major steel and aluminum producing nations to be accepted or opt out. They had reached sort of side deals with the administration. Those are all gone now. There are no more exceptions. These tariffs went into place last month, and they are 25%, not just for the raw materials that are made of steel and aluminum, but also for a lot of downstream derivative type products that are made of steel and aluminum. So captures a lot more products. And these are all based, by the way, on individual tariff codes. We have the harmonized system. There are 17,000 different tariff code descriptions in the United States tariff schedule. And then the normal trade relations duties also apply. Those are determined by tariff code. And there's about 12,000 different rates that correspond to those 17,000 different descriptions. So that is already a lot to keep up with. And then to further things along, the president announced 25% tariffs on autos and auto parts. That was done last month as well. And those went into effect 2 weeks ago. And then on top of that, we have auto parts that will go into effect on May 3rd. And that's duties of 25% on all imports from all countries, with very few exceptions. There's a carve out for products that have U.S. content. So if you're importing something at $100 and 25% of the content is U.S. origin, which you can document, then the duties are only levied at $75 of the $100. So that's a lot to keep up with already. And if that wasn't enough, then of course, last Wednesday, the big announcement was made about the universal, or some people say reciprocal, tariff that hits all products from all countries under all tariff codes that began last Saturday, April 5th. And that is a 10% minimum on every item that's imported, in addition to, again, the normal trade relations duties, any Section 301 China tariffs that have been in place since the first administration, which were continued by President Biden as well, and sometimes increased, any anti-dumping or countervailing duties. We have something else called safeguard tariffs under Section 201. So all of those get rolled up into the new cumulative duty rate. And then starting on Wednesday, April 9th, the 10% minimum will be replaced by country-specific rates that were calculated supposedly based on trade deficits and other practices of foreign trading partners that were perceived to be unfair to the United States. And for instance, all imports from the European Union will go to 20% on Wednesday, plus the other duties. All imports from Vietnam will go to 46% plus the other duties. That's where we are. There's been a lot of developments. Week by week, we seem to have changes, and there may be more coming. But for now, we might be on a little bit of a pause until we see how the other countries retaliate, et cetera.
That's a lot for us to think about. So for companies navigating this, and particularly boardrooms, what do boards need to truly consider in order to mitigate the disruption to their businesses? And maybe mitigate is a loaded term, but maybe we start with the near term and then kind of think more strategically in the longer term.
Well, I think the first thing is that they have to have a clear understanding of their entire supply chain. That's where this really begins, because, you know, once the, for instance, when President Trump first imposed the Section 301 tariffs on Chinese goods, the first reaction was for companies to move their production out of China to other countries like Vietnam or even Mexico, and assume that the assembly in those countries of the same Chinese components would result in a new different country of origin, such that those Section 301 tariffs, which only applied to goods of Chinese origin, would not apply. Unfortunately, they were wrong, because a lot of those parts didn't undergo what we call substantial transformation during the manufacturing process. And even though the product was physically produced in, let's say, Mexico, when it was imported into the United States, the country of origin was still China, and therefore the 25% tariff still applied. So having a clear understanding of where the merchandise comes from and where it's being assembled or manufactured, along with the corresponding tariff impact, that's the hardest thing, I think, for companies to get a handle of, because in most companies that are sort of more the middle market companies have to rely on outside parties most of the time, like customs brokers and freight forwarders, just to get that shipment specific information. And because all of customs and trade revolves around transactions, it's all transaction based reporting. Having a complete understanding of the transactional picture is also important. How much did I pay in duties on this product under this tariff code from this country of origin on such and such a date or date range? That type of stuff is really, really important to having informed decision making. So getting the transactional detail, understanding your complete supply chain, and then understanding the three basic levers that we have to mitigate the financial impact of these tariffs, which basically involve a review of what's called the customs triangle. We always talk about the three legs of the customs triangle being tariff classification, which I mentioned, country of origin, which I mentioned, but also understanding what value is being reported to either U.S. customs or now because so many other countries are retaliating, you know, foreign customs authorities. When you step back and look at global trade, I don't have an exact number, but I think it's about 50% of all world trade takes place between related parties. That means that income tax rules for transfer pricing are going to be implicated when you seek to lower the customs value, because that's generally the one thing that companies are doing right now. They are trying to lower the value of the merchandise that they're importing into the United States to the lowest legally permissible level. But not only do you have to consider the customs valuation rules in undertaking that type of exercise, you also have to consider the impact on transfer pricing, because customs and tax work in opposite directions. For customs, like I said, you want a low value because most duties are calculated ad valorem as a percentage of the value. So the lower the value, then you pay less in duties. Well, that's great, except that on the flip side, with income taxes, you've lowered your inventory basis deduction, meaning you're earning more income, meaning you're going to pay more in income taxes. So that tension, that what we call the whipsaw effect, that has to be managed as well. But you've got to start with having a complete understanding of the entire supply chain and the transactional data in order to make informed decisions going forward about how to address them, both short term, medium term, and long term.
So maybe thinking bigger picture, and I think you mentioned this earlier in your example about moving operations and manufacturing operations. What does that look like at this point? Is that even an option at the current moment to mitigate, or is this much more part of a longer term strategy to reflect? I mean, that's where I think a lot of companies are struggling.
Well, yeah, and that's also the problem, because short term, I can say pretty much that any decisions like that are just on hold, at least for the next couple of months, until we see whatever happens as a result of the new tariffs. There are companies that have been planning to move their locations for manufacturing for other reasons, cost savings, lower labor rates, and maybe even trying to lower the impact of some of the normal trade relations duties, because those are, again, all based on different tariff codes, different products, different countries of origin, as well as trying to take advantage of any potential free trade agreements that are not only out there, but some of them that may be coming in the future. Right now, we have the US-UK free trade agreement that's already been basically completely negotiated and just needs some congressional action to make that happen. There's also talk about creating a new free trade agreement with Kenya, so the US-Kenya free trade agreement. And then we still have all kinds of problems with what's called our Generalized System of Preferences program. That's been a longstanding program that the United States, as well as many other countries, have their versions, where we try and help developing nations by giving tariff concessions and duty-free entry to merchandise that is produced in those what we call beneficiary developing countries, to help lift them up and spur economic growth and activity and further trade relationships specifically with the United States. That legislation has been expired now for over 4 years. It's traditionally been considered a very bipartisan issue, and it's never had any trouble passing Congress before until the last go around 4 years ago, and is still out there. And that also is hindering decision-making about where to relocate or start factories, because those are the countries that need the investment the most and where we can actually buy goods at the cheapest numbers. If we had that legislation in place, it would be a great benefit. So all that stuff is, as if that wasn't enough, there's another issue that seems to be getting some traction on in Washington about changing the rules for country of origin. And that's something that the new U.S. Trade Representative has mentioned, I think, in several times, where we would go from our usual rules, which I'll explain in a minute, to now determining the country of origin by the country of ownership. Like, regardless of whether the factory is in Mexico or Vietnam, who is the actual owner of the factory and where are they located? And then that country would become the new country of origin based on whatever rules they could come up with. Or it may actually require legislation, because right now, the way it works is you have rules of origin that determine the country. Well, number one, if everything is produced in one country, then that's fine. You know, if you're fishing tuna off the coast of Alaska or wherever, the country of origin is generally in the waters where that fish was caught. Same thing as timber, where it's grown, you know, natural resources kind of provisions. But for any type of manufacturing activity, the processing typically occurs across more than one border. So in that case, when you have the final production occurring in one country prior to import, U.S. Customs will look at the rules for substantial transformation, meaning did each one of those raw materials that was used in producing, assembling, or manufacturing the final product, did each one of those raw materials undergo a change in name, a change in character, or a change in use in such a way that a new and different article of commerce results from that processing? It's an incredibly fact-specific kind of labor-intensive determination, looking at man hours during one stage of the production processing, the cost of raw materials. All these different items get thrown into the mix and making that what I would consider very subjective determination about whether a substantial transformation has occurred. That's the rule that U.S. Customs uses for determining country of origin. So until we get some further clarity on whether we're going to change from the true country of origin to the country of ownership, that's another factor that's going to delay investment decisions about where to move factories around the world. And then don't forget the other factor, which is simply the freight costs. I mean, there's been huge spikes in freight costs, international freight costs over the past couple of years due to COVID, obviously, and other factors. And so that also has a big impact on whether you're going to get a landed cost for imported merchandise that you can live with. So that's just a little overview of that issue.
Yikes. Okay. So we're thinking about a lot of things, and, you know, this is a very kind of jigsaw puzzle and of moving parts that you're trying to fit together. So one of the other areas that may not be a primary driver of this, but in some minds, you know, is still considered a hot topic. But what do boards need to take into account or consideration if they're adjusting their overall strategies? Here we're thinking about kind of the corporate social responsibility aspects of this, like, you know, in terms of where ethical sourcing may be, sustainability issues. Thoughts on that?
Oh, yeah. No, that's been a very, very high level issue for the past couple of years. And I think, as you may know, the United States kind of got involved in it, starting with conflict minerals and the, you know, about the diamonds that were mined in Africa and all that back in the mid-teens, I would say. And then we further got into this by looking at the forced labor in the Xinjiang region of China. The United States got together with its allies, but we were the first ones to really come up with a law with teeth called the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. And that passed Congress, I think in, let's see, it was December of 2021. But that law basically said that if you as an importer are trying to bring in merchandise which has even one molecule of something in it that's made with forced labor, so U.S. Customs had a no exception, de minimis exception, no nothing. If any part of that merchandise was made with forced labor in whole or in part, it was refused entry, and the importer would either lose the value of the goods if they couldn't get the seller to take it back. That was really a number one enforcement priority during the Biden administration. At the same time, the Europeans kind of took the lead from us on the forced labor, and they finally got their EU legislation updated last year to begin the process of implementing forced labor prevention laws as well. That's going to come in sort of three stages over the next 3 years. So I would say, especially now in the European Union, the forced labor issue is going to be front and center of the sustainability focus, although they also have the carbon border adjustment mechanism, which also measures the economic impact of producing materials like steel that, you know, rely a lot on doing things that damage the environment. And there's a calculation of an additional duty that's going to be owed for merchandise imported into the EU. The law is already in place, but the problem is the European Council hasn't really figured out a way to implement it in a practical way so that companies can do that calculation of the environmental impact and then translate it into an appropriate tariff rate that would make up for that. So that's still out there. And then the EU has also got the new deforestation rules that are still sort of in the earlier stages, I would say, but that would also impose a tariff consequence if you're illegally conducting foresting operations that are not in compliance with local laws. So those are still big on the European side. I'd say the shift in the United States, although the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act is still on the books, obviously with the new tariff actions under IEEPA and the other methods that the administration is using to implement their tariffs as a way to achieve all of their domestic and foreign policy goals. So there's never, I don't think there's ever going to be a world where we have every single manufactured item that can be made in one single country. But that seems to be the stated goal for the all of these new tariffs. So we shall see.
Last question, maybe just again, bringing it back to the board and complexity of the situation that you've just laid out so nicely, given all these impacts, should the board be looking at their own composition to ensure that they have the right knowledge in these areas and where they're lacking, which I would imagine many boards, particularly smaller boards, potentially, what are the avenues that they can tap into to be better advised on all of this?
Well, that's one thing that I always tell people, customs and trade has always been sort of an unusual, let's say, critter in the whole zookeeping phenomenon of tax and trade compliance, because it's always been viewed more as a logistics and operational issue. And so the traditional, like, in-house departments that you would expect to be knowledgeable about tax, like tax, have not traditionally covered customs duties, which are indirect taxes. So outside the United States, of course, we have value-added taxes all over the world. So every corporate tax department outside the U.S. typically has an indirect tax manager, director, somebody that's tagged with being the gatekeeper and being the in-house person to advise the board and management on these issues. So customs duties are indirect taxes. That's the first thing. So I hope that maybe tax departments out there can take greater ownership in looking at this. But because the universe of candidates with the specialized knowledge to have full range of answers is limited, extremely limited, you're probably going to have to look to outside resources to advise you on this going forward. And if you can find board candidates with that knowledge, that's great. But the main mechanism right now is getting outside advisors to advise management properly on how to address all of these different, very complex, very technical matters at the level of detail, number one, to get a complete understanding of the current lay of the land, so to speak, the current situation, and then figuring out strategies that make sense from a supply chain, tax, customs, you know, all kinds of multidisciplinary things that need to take place to come up with the right answer. Nothing these days, unfortunately, can be viewed in a vacuum. Everything, you know, every reaction, every action has a reaction. And so all that has to be considered, especially in the trade world. So it's got to be not just focused on U.S. customs or U.S. tax matters, but global. And that makes it even harder, because finding somebody who's knowledgeable about all the different countries, as well as the different technical rules in this field, it's extremely hard to find good people and that have those qualifications.
So I'm sure that makes you quite a popular and busy man. So do you recommend for organizations that are doing this and trying to make sure they're not doing it in a vacuum, is there some sort of assessment or other thing that can be helpful to these organizations in trying to pull this together?
Well, sure. I mean, the one thing that we always tell folks first is to get their reports going. Most customs authorities, including U.S. Customs, allow importers to have access to their own transactional data. So we can do it here through the automated commercial environment that's run by U.S. Customs. Every importer can set up their own ACE portal account, gather all the transactional details, and then do the slicing and dicing that's needed to come up with, you know, at least some lay of the land, as I keep saying, for what's happening now. But then to come up with action items going forward and how to address this, because it does impact more than just customs. Trade is not just limited to what it used to be, just paying 2 or 3% in duties and that was it. So nobody really cared. Now, when you're talking about paying 54% on goods from China, 46% on goods from Vietnam, with all these other, it's become a cash flow issue. It's become a procurement issue. It's become a sourcing issue, supply chain. And it's certainly become an income tax issue for the vast majority of companies that engage in international trade, particularly in certain industries like automotive, pharmaceutical. I mean, they're almost entirely global in terms of related party transactions. So that whole transfer pricing angle has to be considered, which I think is why accounting firms are well suited to really do this. I know I'm a lawyer by training and I've worked for big law firms before, and they have great advice on the technical stuff, but in terms of the interplay with other disciplines, it's not always so well thought out, I would say, as we do at a big, large global accounting firm, since we have all the different practices, you know, that we can rely on to help us and make appropriate recommendations for our clients.
Well, I truly appreciate your time, and I won't take up much more of it, but we'll certainly invite you back as this continues to evolve and unfold. So thank you so much, Damon, for your time, and just really appreciate it.
Very, very welcome. Thanks for asking.
All right. Well, thanks to our listeners, and hope to catch you on other episodes of BDO in the Boardroom. Thank you, Damon.
Thank you for listening to BDO in the Boardroom. If you like the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any questions about what we discussed today, reach out to us via BDO.com, where you can also access the resources cited in this episode and learn more about the BDO Center for Corporate Governance. The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of BDO.